Scott Simon has been the host of NPR's Weekend Edition Saturday since the show's first broadcast on November 2nd, 1985. Aside from a brief hiatus in the early 1990s, he's hosted the program for 40 years or so. For Simon, radio is an elemental art form consisting simply of one person speaking and another listening, allowing for evocative storytelling that makes people both think and feel. For Scott Simon, radio is an elemental art form, and it's fair to say that award-winning author Amor Towles is a master of telling evocative stories that make people both think and feel. And in October 2021, Scott Simon welcomed Towles as his guest on Weekend Edition Saturday to talk about his then-recently released novel, The Lincoln Highway. And maybe his belief in the power of radio and his love of the medium is what led Scott Simon to make the choice he did during the conversation. He could have requested any number of compelling passages in the book for Towles to share with the listeners, but Simon said, "I wonder if I can get you to read a section which I loved. In part, it reminded me of Kerouac and Nabokov, both writing about moving across America. It's a section in which Woolley is trying to distract them by listening to a radio, the car radio, which turns out to be a kind of time capsule of America." And Towles begins to read. For a few seconds, Woolley gave the radio his full attention. With his eyes narrowed and his tongue between his teeth, he moved that little orange needle slowly across the spectrum until he could hear the faintest hint of a signal. Then, slowing even further, he would let the signal gain in strength and clarity until he suddenly came to a stop at the incidence of perfect reception. The first signal Woolley landed on was a country music station. He was playing a number about a cowboy on the range who'd either lost his woman or his horse. Before I could figure out which, Woolley had turned the dial. Next up was a crop report coming live to us all the way from Iowa City. Then the fiery sermon of a Baptist preacher. Then a bit of Beethoven with all the edges sanded down. When he didn't even stop for shaboom, shaboom, I began to wonder if anything on the radio was going to be good enough. But when he tuned to 1540, a commercial for a breakfast cereal was just beginning. Letting go of the knob, Woolley stared at the radio, giving the advertisement the sort of attention that one would normally reserve for a physician or a fortune teller. And so it began. Amor Towles reading from his novel, The Lincoln Highway, with Scott Simon on October 19th, 2021, on NPR's Weekend Edition Saturday. The novel is set in 1954, and we're hearing a very popular tune on AM radio that year, Ebb Tide. It turns out that this passage in the Lincoln Highway is not the only place in Amor Towles' work where he refers to radio. In A Gentleman in Moscow, here's what we learn. While a protagonist is confined to a hotel, the radio represents the external, changing Soviet world. The Shukov radio tower and the beacon on top of this famous Moscow landmark is used as a recurring visual motif, and it's even compared to the freckles on one of the characters' back. And in Rules of Civility, which is set in the late 1930s, the radio provides the era's soundtrack. For example, Towles mentions specific programs, such as Bing Crosby performing on a radio show in the early 1940s. Like Scott Simon, Amor Towles believes in the importance and power of radio.
Once a pony time, you dress so fine. To the bums of dime in your prime, didn't you?
Amor Towles was around 8 years old when his ears were open to the music of Bob Dylan. To Bob Dylan and much more. And Towles will soon tell us that story. Amor Towles' award-winning novels have collectively sold more than 8 million copies, and they've been translated into more than 40 languages. His newest book, Table for Two, was an immediate bestseller and called a winner by the New York Times. Towles' first novel, Rules of Civility, was a New York Times bestseller and was named by the Wall Street Journal as one of the best books of 2011. A Gentleman in Moscow was named one of the best books of 2016 by NPR, The Washington Post, and many other outlets. Debuting at number one on the New York Times bestseller list, his third novel, The Lincoln Highway, was one of the New York Times' 100 notable books in 2021, a Washington Post best book of the year, and was also number one on Amazon's list of best books of the year. The novel will be made into a movie, adapted and directed by Christopher Storr for Warner Brothers. Wilkes University has invited Amor Towles to campus as part of its annual series, the Max Rosen Lecture in Law and Humanities, this Sunday, March 15th, at the Dorothy Dixon Dart Center at 2 in the afternoon. Towles will be in conversation with Dr. David Hicks, director of the Maslow Family Graduate Program in Creative Writing at Wilkes, and a writer in his own right. And we had a chance to speak by phone with Amor Towles about the very same passage he read for Scott Simon in 2021, and how music has been a long-standing influence on his writing.
I grew up in the Boston area. I was born in the mid-1960s, and I really don't have a memory of the radio being used in our house when I was a child for much other than sports. You know, my dad would tune in to the Red Sox game or the Celtics game or the Bruins game or the Patriots game. And you had those radio in the kitchen, and that was the principal role it served. You know, I'm talking about when I was 6 and 7 and 8. And along the way, there was an Irish family who lived not far from us, and they had 7 children at least. And over the course of more than a decade, 4 of them babysat for us. Sort of one sibling after another would inherit us as a pack. But Mary Fallon, you know, I just will never forget it. She was the first of them. And she came into our house. And the first thing she did when the parents walked out the door was turn the radio on and set it to, you know, the station she loved and introduced us to really to rock and roll. I mean, for lack of a better word. And as I said in the past, once Mary turned on the radio, it never turned off again, you know. In essence, it was a great age to be introduced to radio, because in Boston at the time there were several radio stations, WKOZ and WBCN, that were, you know, coming out of the 1960s, were really independent rock and roll oriented radio stations with DJs that had personality and that had a lot of power over what they played. And so they could introduce new bands. They could play, you know, the B track that wasn't popular. They could go deep into an album. All those sort of things that can make your introduction to a musical form broaden and in a fantastic way. And so they were really a part of our lives, those DJs, and listening to the music. And eventually, you know, we all, my brother, my sister, and I, we all had our own radios in our bedrooms. Then it was sort of the golden age of clock radio. As a 13-year-old or whatever, that's the way my day would begin, right? You didn't have an alarm. You had the, when the it was time to get up to go to school, and it hit 6:32 or whatever your time was, rather than beep or buzz, the radio came on. And so you just start your day with WCOZ and the team at WCOZ. And You come home and do homework to the radio. After dinner, you'd go to, you retreat to your room with the radio. And, you know, so it was a big thing. And I'm a lifelong fan of classic rock and, you know, the vinyl era. And it really all began with Mary Fallon. And it probably had as much influence on me as a writer as literature has had. You know, this music has been such a vibrant form, you know, over the course of my, from the age of 10 to whatever, you know, still today, Bob Dylan and Bruce Springsteen and Beatles and, you know, Led Zeppelin, and, you know, they were all influences.
And that's such a powerful thing for a writer to say that about radio. And one of the things that we always talk among ourselves about, we love the fact, and we learned in COVID about the intimacy of the DJ with the listener. And how when people were isolated in the COVID era, they would call and say, I don't know what we'd do without you. We need the music. We need to know you are there living and breathing and talking to us. So there's something about voice there too, isn't it?
Yeah, no question about it. It was personality-driven radio. You know, you kind of knew at different hours of day that the different DJs were going to bring a sort of a different tone and open different doors for you. You know, there was the DJ on who would do the late shift, who would put on more experimental music, you know, deeper tracks of Pink Floyd than you could get away with playing during drive time, you know, that sort of thing. And so, yeah, it was very much, you thought of them as people that you knew personally. You had a sense of what their taste was, and, you know, it was a connection.
Did you ever make requests?
Yeah, and of course, we did that too. You know, you tried to be the 17th caller to get the tickets to the concert and all that stuff. Absolutely.
And so we're driving across the country in your novel, and we've got the car radio on. That's not just a throwaway, keep the characters busy while they're in the car kind of thing with you.
Yeah, you're talking about in the Lincoln Highway.
Yeah.
Yeah, and music is in, you know, plays a part in most of my books. And music from different genres. I mean, in Rules of Civility and set in 1938 in New York, there's a sort of a jazz element that runs through the course of the book. And the classical repertoire has more of an influence in A Gentleman of Moscow. And, you know, where the main character is a great fan of Tchaikovsky's and talks about the music. And we hear that music in the background. It's a complement to the events and to the sort of tonality of the work. But yes, so you take the Lincoln Highway, and kind of one of the interesting thing about that book is it's set in 1954, and it's just 10 days. And when I had finished writing the book, only then did I sort of ask myself, why did I set this in 1954? You know, my instinct was it should be in 1954. And I built the story out of that moment in time. But the question is to why. I mean, could it have been in 1958 or 1962 or 65 or, you know. And in retrospect, what I really liked about that moment in time and why it suited that story, these three young 18-year-olds and a younger brother who are on their way from the Midwest to the East Coast, you know, on a road trip, as it were, 1954 was a time when America was about to go through some incredible changes. And the forces for those changes were very much in place, but they were about to sort of break the surface and reshape American society in a profound way that would have ramifications for the next half a century. So, you know, what am I talking about? Well, I'm talking about, for instance, the modern civil rights movement. The modern civil rights movement really begins in 1954 because of the Brown versus the Board of Education decision, which came in that 12-month period and which outlawed segregation. And was resulted in very quickly, you know, the marches and the sit-ins, Rosa Parks and her peers who were in, you know, sitting in stools in drugstores they weren't supposed to be sitting on and waiting for the police to come take them away. That whole era, you know, which goes from Rosa Parks and Martin Luther King and then just keeps moving for, you know, until ultimately the Civil Rights Act is passed a decade later, begins in 1954. And as I say, all the dynamics of American society at that point were in place to have that revolution unfold. The era of the new era of love, or what you want to call it, of The sexual revolution is beginning in 1954. 1954 is when Kinsey is writing his report and the pill is being researched and, you know, Playboy magazine is launched. So all these sort of dynamics that ultimately define the sexual revolution of the 60s and 70s is beginning at that moment in time. The Vietnam War is beginning. It hasn't really had begun to result in the significant draft, but the battle is being fought and the path is being laid for the end of this sort of post, this moment of peace. So all these things are happening, but one of them is rock and roll. Rock and roll, you know, most people say, begins basically in 1954. You know, take your song, pick your song, but you know, let's say it's Rock Around the Clock, you know, commonly thought of as the first rock and roll song, comes out in 1954 and you know, changes American society dramatically. Because for the first time, really in the history of anywhere, teenagers have their own medium, which they are writing, they are performing, you know, teenagers and young 20-year-olds, writing, performing about their lives, and it's being broadcast so that it's not just complaining to your neighbor. It is, you could write a song that could reach, you know, a million kids around the world. And so it's not a coincidence that the political activism that teenagers adopted in the 1960s was bound to the radio and to the sound of rock and roll. It was a dialogue, basically, between that musical form and the youth culture as they were, you know, making new decisions, approaching, you know, sex in a different way, approaching the use of drugs, approaching the political action in a different way, thinking about freedom, you know, from expectation and parents and moral habits. All that was going back and forth between the teenager in his or her car and the radio, you know, and the rock bands playing on the radio. And, you know, that really changed in many ways the course of American history, you know, where that youth suddenly had an impact on the way things happened in the country, at least some impact. They're not running the show, but they're having an impact that they had never had before at any time in history, anywhere in the world. And so the radio, having the radio turned on in Lincoln Highway is very much, as you say, it's not just dressing. It's partly because it's not rock and roll yet. That's not what they're hearing. But the 18-year-olds in the car are all, they're the ones who are feeling the pressures of racism or sexism or the middle-class expectations and are prepared to throw them off and are kind of looking for a new outlet. So I kind of, you turn on the radio, it's sort of a gesture to the fact of wait a second, because here it comes, guys. You know, what you're craving is about at any moment is going to play on this radio and you're never going to turn it off again. And the ideas of the battle of women's rights plays a sort of a similar role. You have a young woman in that book who is beginning to argue with her father in a way that, you know, she's frustrated with being slotted into a particular expectation. So, similar with racial dynamics in that book. So you have sort of the indications of the disruption that is coming, and the turning on of the radio in that car is one version of that.
And by the time you start listening to the radio, freeform radio, it has done that booming out of the songs, yes, the Dylans and so forth, right?
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. But, you know, so, but I think back on it, let's say I was 8 years old when it began in our household, when Mary Fallon turned on the radio. And so that's 1972. And growing up then from the, so, you know, from the age of 8 to the age of 15 or 16, there was a sort of mindset that it seemed like these were songs that had been around forever. They were the bands of another generation. It, almost that's the way that you heard them. But it was only a few years before, right? So Woodstock was only, you know, four years before the radio was turned on. But it seemed like to me like it could have been a generation away. Because at the age of 8, you don't really have that sense of where you are in the historical continuum. You know, if it's being played on the radio, then it must have come from another time. And, you know, and then occasionally you say, oh, yeah, I know this song's a new song. And that's part of my moment. And, you know, say Springsteen, where he comes and you really feel like, oh, yeah, this is a guy who's playing. Whereas the Beatles felt like, and Dylan felt like from another time. But as I say, it was actually a very short distance between when that music was being created and it's when its impact was about to start happening and when it showed up in my house. You know, we were just sort of naive listeners excited by what we were hearing.
You also have spoken very eloquently about, and I have it in my hand actually, because I'm sitting in a production studio with perhaps 1,000 LPs and they're AAA, and I have Jackson Browne's Running on Empty in my right hand here.
Yeah.
You've been able to explain to us about how something like an album created in this way has a narrative that might be influential in terms of or compared to writing with words.
And it's true. You know, that's a door you could open up and I could talk about forever, right? So I'll try to be more sort of directed in my response. But one of the things that made the vinyl LP so impactful as a medium was that it was 45 minutes roughly in time with two sides. So you had 20 minutes and 20 minutes. And what happened very, very quickly, particularly driven by the rock and roll generation, and to some degree by the jazz musicians. But most popular music pre 1960 is people making songs. You know, they're not even writing the songs. Someone's writing the songs for them. They're public personalities like Sinatra. And, you know, the songs are written by different people potentially. And, you know, maybe they might be a thematic tie of like, it's an album of love songs or what have you. But what really happens, sort of going into the 60s, I say the jazz guys have begun this, but the rock and roll guys really pick it up, which is to say that they're viewing the album as a single work of art and at the top of the field. And so the Beatles are organizing and composing Sgt. Pepper's as a single composition where the different songs are tied to each other in some important way. The order of them has been carefully selected. There is an overall sense of thematics that the songs, you know, play together. And you end up with, you know, very extreme examples of this, very self-conscious examples like Sgt. Pepper or Dark Side of the Moon by Pink Floyd, where it is a concept album. And in many, you know, there's not even much of a break between the songs as they sort of sound, sort of drift from one song into the next. Well, Running on Empty is by Jackson Browne. It's really one of the great versions of this, you know, at the pinnacle of this, in that the entire album is composed about the life of a musician on the road, all the songs. And many of them are composed while they were touring, and in fact recorded, if you go back and read the liner notes, you know, one song's recorded in a hotel room. One is recorded actually on the tour bus. There's a song where the first half of it is recorded in a hotel room, and it suddenly shifts in the middle and it's live in the stadium, you know, with a crowd of whatever, you know, 20, 30, 40,000 people cheering. And so you have that sort of young poetic songwriter, Browne, you know, who's already famous and he's, you know, already in the rock and roll scene, but now reflecting on his experience and beginning to almost like a short story writer, like a Raymond Carver, you know, having just lived through a difficult time of, you know, in a working class period in his life, is writing a series of stories about the people he knew who were struggling to get by and dealing with alcoholism or with lost jobs or marriages that were fragile, you know, and discussions in the kitchen. Carver's doing that same thing as what Jackson Browne is doing in that record, is really piecing together a series of encounters and the different roles that people play, the roadies versus the young woman who waits, you know, outside the concert hall in the hopes of meeting you, or the way the band members are interacting. And So it is. It's very much about narrative. And obviously, Springsteen's Nebraska is a version of that. Springsteen's Nebraska is probably one of the best collections of short stories, of American short stories written in that decade. Because again, it was sort of along that sort of similar thing of trying to tell a series of stories that were interlinked and that were thematically cohesive.
The thing about us here at WVIA is that we broadcast classical music. We have AAA and all the names you mentioned. That we actually own a jazz label, Chiaroscuro. And so we do all of those things that you have mentioned about jazz and so forth. But I think our classical listeners might be curious about the notion of a symphony and how you think about a musical symphony and also about a narrative, and how there might be a comparison that you would make that might be fascinating for our listeners.
Yeah, I appreciate the question. I often have felt that if you think of the novel as an art form within the written word, and think about different types of art forms that are in sort of our daily cultural life, I do think that the novel is more akin to the symphony or the sonata than it is to many other of our art forms, whether they're visual or tonal or, whether it's painting or even film. Because the thing about the novel, or the novel is closer to the symphony than it is to poetry, for instance. So it's closer to the musical output of a symphony than it is to the written form of a poem. And that's because of formal and structural reasons, right? So that the symphony is composed, Mozart or Beethoven, symphony at its height, where there are movements and where there are themes that are picked up and played. There are motifs, and the motif expressing a particular theme within the symphony may be revisited over the course of the symphony in different ways, so that here we hear it just, as an oboe solo, but then later we hear it with the string section, and it's revisited with the entire orchestra in the form of a crescendo. And like, the course of the symphony, you have shifts in moods as we go through the various movements, a shift in tempo as we go through the different instruments that are deployed. And all these are aspects basically of the novel, meaning that, the chapter is the novel's version of the movement in essence, but the motifs that are picked up and revisited at different tempos, at different moods, with different sort of, our version of instruments, as it were, that's a part of it too. And like the symphony at its best, I think the symphony at its finest, you get to this moment where there's great economy to it, meaning that every movement that you have heard, every bar that you've heard belongs there. There's nothing missing, and there's nothing extra. It is perfectly cohesive. And with Mozart and Beethoven, we have that dynamic where you get to the closing of the symphony, and there's that feeling of, oh, yes, there it is. It has brought all together. What the journey that I've been going on through the music is culminating, and I'm hearing those various motifs recalled, and the crescendo is coming, and it ends, and you're like, exactly right. That's the way it should be. And the novel, I think, it can achieve this in its finest way, where all the various elements, the characters, the events, the language that's been used, the imagery, the poetry of it can sort of culminate as it comes to a close. And at its best, we have that same feeling as a reader of thinking that not a sentence was missing from this story, and nor were there sentences that did not belong there. It was cohesive and wholesome. And I should say that, as given your listeners, and I do write about different genres of music, and the classical is that probably an interesting side is that I don't tend to write about my own personal experiences, but the single most autobiographical thing I've ever written were the first four pages of Story of the Bootlegger in my collection, The Table for Two, which was the last book that was published of mine. And that is centered around Carnegie Hall and a classical music performance. And it comes from the fact that when I was 30, my wife and I were going to a series at Carnegie Hall where you have the same seat for every performance over the course of several months of a series. And I realized that the guy sitting next to me every Saturday was recording the concerts. And I just could not, it drove me crazy, kind of. I would be like, I couldn't stop thinking about this guy recording the concerts with his hidden microphones sticking out of his sleeves of his trench coat. And at one point, I was like, I'm going to turn that guy in, you know, and sort of would fantasize about that while I was listening to the music. But so many years later, 20 years later, 25, 30 years later almost, I went back and revisited that experience at Carnegie Hall and imagined, what if the young couple after the concert, having recognized that the old man next to them is recording, what if the young man turned him in and we see what happens? And it's all done against the backdrop of Stephen Isserlis playing the cello, and particularly the Bach suite for cello. And one of the great things I love about that particular story is it gave me a chance to write about that piece of Bach in detail, you know, because I have loved it so much. And it was a great pleasure to see how to build that piece of music into the story and try to mimic, in a way, the emotional experience I have listening to it. I'm trying to mimic that through language so that someone reading it would have some glimpse of that same sort of emotional impact, even though they're not hearing the music directly.
Stephen Isserlis is such a remarkable cellist. Were you able to talk with him about what he was up to with his Bach performances?
Yes, I was. And he and I became friends through social media. He was a fan of my writing and had reached out. And so I connected with him, and I knew his music. And so, you know, we became friends, and I've seen him perform a number of times. And, you know, we see each other in London and New York when we can. And so, yes, when I was writing the story, I reached out to him. And I said, hey, Stephen, I'm going to have this performance in Carnegie Hall at the center of this story. And I thought I might do cello. You know, do you mind if it's you? And he was like, oh, my God, absolutely. Make it, you know, please make it me. And so when I finished the story and did a draft of it, I sent it to him to get his sort of his impressions and also his notes about where I might have been off. And that, you know, was very helpful. And, you know, good example, it was that I have him at one point during the concert in the first draft, glancing at his watch to see how much time is left in the, he has in the performance. And as he very politely pointed out to me, a cellist would never, ever wear a watch in a performance. And I said, well, you know, is that because you want to focus on the music and you don't want to be, you know, send the wrong signal to the audience? And he's like, no, anymore. It's not for that. It's because the cello is worth $1 million. You know, so you don't, when you're playing an 18th century cello, you do not wear a watch because you don't want to scratch the surface of the instrument, you know. So we took the watch out of the story. It's a very helpful note from Stephen.
You just told us the delightful story of Stephen Isserlis and the cello and the watch. When it comes to time, telling time in your novel, Rules of Civility, you cite the historic 1938 Benny Goodman concert at Carnegie Hall as a musical marker of the 30s. And you point to the shift from the big band sound to the more intimate jazz ensembles.
Yeah, because if we think about those two different styles of jazz, the swing era where it's an orchestra really there, and obviously the tempo is defined by the name of the music in itself. So a swinging beat to it was very often played in halls where there was dancing. It was broadcast on the radio on Saturday night from hotel ballrooms, and it was, you know, a very popular, collaborative, upbeat environment. And, you know, this was the music that really dominated the scene going into the Second World War, for the decade leading into the Second World War. But then you have this shift where there's a new exploration really built around the trio, the quartet, the quintet. and very often more moody, more personal, more exploratory, in environments that are more private and dark and simple, you know, as opposed to the big bandstands with guys in tuxedos and in well-lit ballrooms. And so you really had a whole shift in the musical style, but that obviously is tied to a sort of a change in mood, and a change in artistic exploration, a change in people's position in society. All of these things are related to that. And so the creation of Miles Davis's Kind of Blue is absolutely a reflection of a sort of an aspect of the spirit of the moment in time that wasn't simply Miles Davis's, but was shared by, you know, tens of thousands of New Yorkers or hundreds of thousands of millions of Americans. And of course, that's why the album was so successful, is it spoke to so many people so quickly, so profoundly, you know, in the same way that, you know, Benny Goodman and Glenn Miller and, you know, those guys were speaking to their generation with a very different style of sound.
Best-selling novelist Amor Towles speaking with us by phone in anticipation of his visit to Wilkes University this Sunday, March 15th, for the annual Max Rosen Lecture in Law and Humanities. Towles is known for his novels, Rules of Civility, A Gentleman in Moscow, and The Lincoln Highway, and in 2024, Table for Two, which is a collection of short fiction. Towles will be speaking at the Dorothy Dixon Dart Center at 2 o'clock on Sunday without charge, and he will be in conversation with Dr. David Hicks, director of the Maslow Family Graduate Program in Creative Writing at Wilkes. Alas, Wilkes has let us know that all of the seats for the event have been reserved, and so reservations are closed. But you can visit Towles' website, which is amortowles.com, amortowles.com, A-M-O-R-T-O-W-L-E-S. Amor Towles at Wilkes University for the annual Max Rosen Lecture in Law and Humanities this Sunday afternoon at 2. Reservations are closed, but you can check his website, amortowles.com.